ATV presents Black Renaissance, an informal discussion of topics concerning the black community. Your host, Sam Skinner.
Hello, welcome to Black Renaissance. The title of this book, Street Fighter in the Courtroom. Our guest this evening is a man that I have admired. There's very few lawyers that I admire. And a man that I think that a lot of Americans who understand humanity have to admire. His book is called The Street Fighter in the Courtroom. His name is Charles Geary. Those of us who have lived through the 60s and were involved in the 60s and in the early 70s know what Charles Geary stands for. The Trial of Chicago, the Chicago 7, is a trial that will live on forever. And I always talk about the Democratic Convention that year, that the Democratic Convention did something that nothing else was able to do. It brought blacks and whites together in an understanding, because for the first time white people saw white kids being banged around by policemen. And we could tell them all the time they used to do that, but until they saw it, they didn't believe it. Charles, I would like to talk about the Chicago 7 trial and talk about in essence of your book about the trial. A man was taken to court and shackled with chains because he told this judge that basically he had no respect for him. And I have not been able to figure out, maybe you'll be able to explain to me during the show, if I have no respect for the judge and I tell him so that at least he understands that he doesn't have any respect to say, hey, because his robe does not represent justice. Now, he's on an instrument and using those books to supposedly get it. Why did he feel it so necessary to then put Bobby Seale in chains automatically, without any doubt in anybody's mind, if I'm a jury, say, hey, those dudes are guilty? Because if I see you in shackles and chains, that means you are a violent and vicious animal.
Well, that's exactly what I tried to portray in the San Quentin 6 trial, where all of the defendants, with the exception of one who was no longer in prison at the time of the trial, the shackling and chaining the defendants in the courtroom while we were picking the jury, and from the trial thereon, that immediately prejudiced the jury, that our clients were men who had nothing but force and violence propensities. And going a step further, in the Chicago 7 or the Chicago 8 case, there were originally 8 with Bobby Seale in the case. And I was chief counsel in the case. And 10 days before the trial, the doctors told me I had to have an emergency gallbladder operation. And we asked for a 30-day continuance. And the court said no. And Bobby Seale said he would have no other attorney except myself. He didn't trust anyone else. That I'd represented him in the past, I was going to represent him in this trial, and without me, he was not going to go to trial. Now, to begin with, let's talk about the judge for a minute. The first time we went into that courtroom was in April of 1969. The first thing that the judge said to Mr. Dellinger, who was one of the defendants, and he said, "You plead guilty, of course, don't you?" And Dave Dellinger said, "Not guilty, of course." Then the judge says to the clerk, leaned over to the clerk, and he said, "Mr. Clerk," he said, "will you remind the defendant that that's not the proper way to plead?" That was the beginning of our first entrance into that courtroom.
And the stage was set automatically by the judge.
Of course. He was acting the part of a clown, but a clever clown. And he was playing up to the multitudes of the press and the media, and the trial from that day until the trial ended some months later was a circus. And he was the clown, the circus master. And every time that there was a repartee between the judge and Bill Kunstler, and if Bill got the best of the judge in the repartee, he would hold him in contempt of court. So when the trial was finished, Bill Kunstler was facing some 4 years in the penitentiary.
He got the best of the judge that many times.
Right. And but getting back to the beginning of that trial, the judge did all of the questioning of the jurors, and it took less than 4 hours to get that jury. In a highly controversial case, a case of first impression that was being tried in the United States. It was a conspiracy trial, and I'll talk about conspiracy in a minute. But while picking the jury, he asked perfunctory questions. Can you be fair? Even Adolf Hitler could say he could be fair with the Jews, right?
Right.
And can you be fair? And of course the defense had submitted some 17 or 18 pages of questions that he should ask about their attitude of the Vietnam War, their attitude towards Mayor Daley and all of the other things about the Democratic Convention. He didn't ask any of those questions. And an interesting thing that happened while picking the jury, a black woman was one of the prospective jurors. And he says to her, he said, "What do you do?" And she said, "I work for the United States Attorney. I work, oh, domestic, of course," says the judge. United States Attorney says, "No, Your Honor, she's my secretary." Now that shows the mentality of this man. Domestic, of course. And so when Bobby Seale, who knew that he was being railroaded, and he could see all of the pictures of some of the slave owners' presidents in the wall behind the judge in this federal court. By the way, I've never seen that before in any court, where they have pictures all over the place. And he sees all of these pictures, and the pictures of the men that he has posted up there were all slave owners, and he wouldn't let Bobby have his own lawyer. He said, "If you don't let me have my own lawyer, who's Charles Gary, let me speak for myself." "No, you're not going to speak for yourself either." And finally, after the fifth week of this kind of seance on the part of the court, Bobby Seale said, "I will not put up with this any longer." So the judge ordered him gagged and shackled and chained. And he sat in that courtroom for 10 days that way. And it reminded all of us, I was in the hospital at the time, it reminded all of us that the Dred Scott decision was being reenacted. And it was pathetic. And we were outraged at that. Now that was in what? 1970?
That's right.
1970, when that trial was going on. 69 and 70. And in 1975...
Hold it. We're going to take a break. We're going to pick up. We're going to take the transfer from 1970 to 1975 with our guest, the street fighter in the courtroom himself. Attorney Charles Gary, join us here in 1 minute, please. Our guest today, Attorney Charles Gary, who says in his book, "It is evident that real justice is not easily obtainable in this country until we can find answers to poverty, racism. I don't think we can talk about justice." And we're not exactly talking about justice. When we left, we were talking about Bobby Seale's trial of being shackled in the 1970s when that was going on, and the fact that we were reliving the Dred Scott whole thing all over again. We're now dealing with 1975. San Quentin 6 and nothing has changed?
Well, something has changed. Whereas in 1970 and 69, we were shocked to see a Bobby Seale gagged and shackled and chained like a wild animal. But in 1975, in the San Quentin 6 case, the judge decided on his own, without any evidence whatsoever, that those six defendants must be shackled and chained. And he told the prospective jurors, the fact that these men are shackled and chained, you're not to take that into consideration. And for 17 months, these men
shackled
and chained. To give you one example of many that I could tell, but one that I'd like to tell you. Johnny Spain, the young man that I represent, was shackled and chained, and he had a back problem. And during the course of the time we were picking the jury, he had to be hospitalized at the San Francisco County Hospital for about 6 weeks for examinations. They thought he had cancer because he had this back condition that they couldn't find an answer as to why that existed. So that during the course of the trial, he said to me, "Tell the judge that I've got to go to the bathroom." So I said, "Your Honor, excuse me, Mr. Spain has to go to the bathroom." He says, "Mr. Spain can wait for 20 minutes. We're going to have our recess in 20 minutes. So what does Spain do after about 3 or 4 minutes of squirming around? He urinates right in the courtroom. And just remember that. And
the judge was incensed at the fact?
No, we won't say anything about it at this moment. At the end of the trial, the judge is justifying why these men were shackled and chained. And one of the reasons that he gave for shackling and chaining these defendants was that Mr. Spain had urinated in the courtroom. Now, how do you like that for logic?
He justified urinating as reason that he should be shackled.
Yes.
Now, wait a minute.
He was shackled and chained all along anyway.
Now, wait a minute. You talk about people who are sitting on a bench that are supposed to be college educated, supposed to be one of our more intelligent people. And you're trying to tell me that somewhere along the line, this judge did not understand, got his logic all mixed up?
Got his logic all mixed up. To give you an example of the difference in judges and human beings, long before the trial ever started, we had what we call pre-trial discovery matters and so forth, and we attacked the grand jury in Marin County as being unrepresentative of the peer group of our clients. And in the course of that hearing about the grand jury challenge, which took some 6 weeks, I challenged the judge that was in the case, the same judge, on the grounds that he was a participant in the legal process of the grand jury and there should be another judge come in. Got that?
Okay.
In the meantime, all during the months that this judge was hearing these motions, the defendants were calling him all kinds of names. They couldn't stand him. They would start with the alphabet and go through it. And you know how pungent those the vocabulary is. And the judge himself would act in such a way that would invite this. For instance, the defendants would say, "These shackles and chains are so tight, our hands are getting numb, or our waist is getting numb, or we can't write, we can't converse because we're chained right to our belt." He wouldn't say anything at all. He would just completely ignore it. And then after a few minutes, they would start with the alphabet again. They would call him all kinds of names. And it was just pungent. Now, this had been going on for almost 2 or 2.5 years in pretrial matters. So that when I made the motion that we ought to have another judge hearing the question of the grand jury challenge, of course, he stepped aside and they brought in a judge who had been retired. His name was Judge Stoll. The minute Judge Stoll walked in, the whole atmosphere was different. For instance, when he walked in, he sat down at the bench and he said, "How are you, fellows?" You know, fellows, human beings. And they said in response, "Fine, Judge, how are you?" And the judge says, "I'm not feeling so well." And says one of the defendants, "Take care of yourself, brother." You see what I'm getting at? The attitude. And this went on for 6 weeks. And whenever they would complain that the chains were too tight, he'd get off of the bench and he'd come over there and look at it. He says, "This is too tight. Loosen it." The guard would say, "But, loosen it." You see what I'm getting at? Didn't cost him anything. And at Christmas time, because the hearing was still going on in January. Christmas time of that year, these men, on their own, sent him a Christmas card. All of them signed it with all kinds of cute remarks about take care of yourself, right on, power to the people, you know, all right. This kind of stuff. And one of the reporters who was covering the story wrote about the contrast in judges. The contrast in human beings. And of course, after the judge found that the grand jury was not representative of the cross-section of the community and declared the entire indictment invalid, and the state appealed, and then the appellate court reversed this judge, and we had to go back to trial before the same judge that we had all of this difficulty before. And for some 18 months, we were on trial, which was the longest trial in American history in the criminal courts. Now, the thing that I want to emphasize is where we were in shock when we saw Bobby Seale gagged and shackled and chained. In 1975, when that trial started before that jury, we accepted the idea of shackling and chaining.
The president had been set in Chicago.
Right. But it's that erosion, you know, that happens a little bit at a time, and the first thing you know, it becomes the way of life. Just like the first time that I walked into the courtroom in Chicago before Judge Hoffman, they wanted us to be searched. I said to the other attorneys with me, "We're not going in. We're going to be searched." So the United States attorney came and got us, and we went through the chambers of the judge to go in so we wouldn't have to be searched. I remember in San Bernardino when I was handling the case 4 years ago, when the court ordered that I would have to be searched and my briefcase would have to be searched. I refused to go in, and the press came in, took pictures of me, and so forth. Now, 4 years ago, 2 years later, in the San Quentin 6 case, when the trial started, I had to be searched along with all of the other lawyers 3 times. It's before you even walked into the courtroom. You had to go through electric eye, and then when you got into the entrance to the courtroom itself, you had to allow your briefcases, all of your papers. They would go through them. They'd break them up to see if there wasn't some weapons in there. What I'm saying is that we start out at first by rebelling, then eventually by erosion we give up those basic rights.
Right.
And that's what I'm afraid is going to happen in America when we have a police state. It's going to come by erosion.
Let me stop you just at that point. We're going to take a break and come back. We're going to talk about the process of erosion of one's rights here in the United States. Join us in 1 minute, please. Today, the street fighter in the courtroom himself, Attorney Charles Geary, has a book out. It's an important document that you read and get an understanding of, because it makes you think about those things which are going on in our courtroom. And you know, when you think about it, I was before we went on, I was telling you about the fact that I was raised as a kid to understand, love, cherish the thing called justice. Fight for justice, believe that a man is given his due right. But then you listen and on your television, you read your newspapers, and you hear judges talk, and you realize that justice has nothing to do with what is going on. So I'm saying that I'm wondering, are we being sold a bill of goods in schools about justice, and justice has really got nothing to do with what's going on in the world?
Well, you see, when you see the courtroom, they have the scales which are supposed to balance justice, right?
Right.
And I tell the story in my book about Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was a justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court, and in 1900 he was appointed to go on the United States Supreme Court, where he stayed for many, many years. And they gave him a dinner in Boston, going away party or dinner. And at this dinner, everybody extolled his virtues. And many of them said, now that Holmes is going to the United States Supreme Court, he's going to take justice with him. And when it came his time to respond to all of these many gratuities, he stood up and he said, friends, he said, thank you for the kind words and the salutations. But he said, when I go to the United States Supreme Court, I'm not going to take justice. He said, justice has nothing to do with our courts. He said, our courts are relegated to deciding rules and regulations so that our society doesn't run into each other. He said, justice belongs into the ecclesiastics, the clergy, and other areas, but not in the courtroom. And before Holmes ever said that, or before I ever heard about Holmes saying that, I knew that that was true. I knew that there's no such thing as justice in the courtroom. It's a question of who is right legally. It has nothing to do with justice. As a matter of fact, a person can win a lawsuit and be morally wrong, because morally wrong means that there's no justice, right? And the question is, how do we get justice? Can we get justice? If we had justice in America or in any part of the world, there wouldn't be any hunger. There would not be any want. There would not be any deprivation. Because justice requires that human beings be equally treated, have equal opportunities, not only equal opportunities, but equal results. You know, we keep talking about equal opportunities. It doesn't make any difference. You and I could have equal opportunities, and immediately you can do things that I cannot do.
Right.
But equal results mean something. Then you're balancing the equities, and then you're seeing to it that I would get a piece of that pie, and you not get all of the pie. I should get part of it.
Right.
You see what I'm getting at?
Right.
And until we have that, if I was a judge tomorrow, there's nothing I could do. There's nothing I could do except give temporary relief to someone who finds himself into the clutches of what we call organized law.
And yet the newspapers would say, because of your background and fight, that you would be so different and you would be bringing justice to the courtroom. You understand the people, and as you say, the ball game has already been set.
The rules are there, and you have to follow those rules. And it has nothing to do with justice. It has nothing to do with equity. Equity means justice. As a matter of fact, even in the old English law, equity was judged on the length of the chancellor's foot. If he had a short foot, the equity was short. And if he had a long foot, it was somewhat longer. But it still depended upon the length of his shoe. And our world has been that way. It's a dog-eat-dog society. And today, where we talked about Watergate and the police state and everything else, and assumed that Watergate is behind us and we've learned our lesson and we're not going to have unlawful conduct on the part of the government, you just go into the ghettos of America, any part, the white ghettos, black, red, green, it doesn't make any difference the color. The ghettos of America know that there is a Watergate constantly in their community. They know that the police and the oppression and the hunger and the want is constantly there. And until we solve that, and just short time ago, the death penalty was reenacted in California. And the men that we elected to the Sacramento legislature are supposed to be, by and large, because they're Democrats, they're supposed to be closer to the will of the people or the need of the people. What did they do?
They reversed it. And I hate to do it, Charles, but time has run out on us. We could go on forever. The book is The Street Fighter in the Courtroom. The man is Charles Gary, a man that will go down in history as one of those great lawyers and great human beings. Join us next week for another edition of Black Renaissance.
Well, pick it up just by sitting on it. Oh, I don't think so. Let me turn off your thing.
Wait.
Fuck you.
Striking Marin County.